It's my great pleasure today to have in the studio Tom Begich. And Tom, there are two topics I'm very much interested in having you talk about, muse about, etc. And the first one has to do with now not so recent, ongoing issue dealing with redistricting in the state of Alaska. I understand you had some knowledge about that.
Oh, I had a series of clients throughout the process, but actually not quite done yet. There's still some pleadings in terms of attorney's fees and things like that that were filed as recently as last week in the case. It's not done until the, rather nondescript middle-aged man sings, I guess.
That's an interesting way to put it. Well, we can do this two ways. We can work back or we can work forwards. But let's start with for listeners who are somewhat aware of what this is all about, but may be a little blurry. Tell us a little bit why we redistrict and how this came about.
Sure. The primary process of redistricting, which is established at the federal level, in our Constitution, basically makes the argument though this is somewhat questionable now, but makes the argument that every decade we should redraw lines to elect our state House, state Senate, and United States House members because populations shift and change, and you want to, as much as possible, create districts that are representative of the population. A case called Baker v. Carr in the 60s, we established that one person, one vote was a primary consideration. And then through the Civil Rights Acts, we also established other types of concerns or considerations that should be kept in mind. So you both want to protect the right of a person's vote to be as worth as much in Wasilla as it is in Anchorage or as it is in Queetluck, as well as ensure that there's no overt discrimination that occurs. That's basically what the general redistricting laws are intended to do. So every decade, depending on the state, you redraw the lines. And in Alaska, in Alaska, that process used to be done by the governor. The governor would appoint the board of five people who would serve and draw those lines. If the governor changed during that time period, then a new group of five people would be appointed. And so you could have all kinds of conflict. And then in the late 90s, we changed the Constitution to create a five-member board, two appointed by the governor, one by the House, one by the Senate, and one by the Supreme Court. So every decade, they've been drawing those lines.
Oh.
That's pretty much the scope of it.
That's quick and okay. So now we're at this situation where we have these five people that have been variously put there with this responsibility. Then they have help, and in part, I think this is probably where you come in.
Maybe.
At least stirring the pot.
Well, the way the process works up here, and I think, this board had a number of – there were faults with this board. It went through its first director died while serving a man I respected, Ron, was somebody I respect a lot. And he was replaced by his deputy, a guy named Taylor Bickford, who did a very good job as well. The board, had its failings. It had some fairly strong-willed people, John Torgerson, the chair, former state senator, very strong-willed man, fellow from Fairbanks, Jim Holm, was also quite opinionated. But it also had some moderating voices in the group. The member from Kotzebue and the member from Kodiak both were rather moderate voices, Marie Green from Kodiak and Bob from down in Kodiak. I mean, from Kotzebue and Bob from down in Kodiak. Together, they worked out a process where they would not make decisions unless they did so collectively and equally. Now, four of those appointees were Republican, and one was a nonpartisan, Marie Green. Marie was appointed by the court, but the Senate coalition appointed a Republican, Bob Brody from Kodiak, and the House coalition. Republican-dominated coalition appointed a Republican, and that was Peggy Ann McConaughey from Juneau, who's a fairly stalwart party regular with Republicans as well. but was open to listening to the arguments from both Bob Brody and Marie Greene, which helped create a dynamic that former Senator Torgerson respected in that board, which was very interesting because it was very – we want – you know, as partisan Democrats, and I am a partisan Democrat, we want to dislike in a sense, you know, the opposition when they control a board. But these guys actually worked with people, I think. They did a fairly open process. They did things that were a little bizarre, some thought. But some of those bizarre creations in the initial plan were because of the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, I don't want to belabor your listeners with a lot of tech talk, but the Voting Rights Act would have ensured that we maintained a number of Alaska Native majority districts. And then that all changed this last summer when the Supreme Court changed the Voting Rights Act's provisions. Okay. So
on a practical basis, what I've noted is that there, as the next election season is upon us, there are many people that have been watching for kind of a finalization of this process as they consider whether they're going to jump into one race or another. So you've mentioned that there's still perhaps some detail to be made final. Right now, what has changed as a result of the redistricting board's activities for this upcoming election as we know it now?
The details that remain to be finalized will not affect the map. Okay. The map is done. Okay. The map that is now available on their website and will soon be published around the state, soon be used to issue your voter cards, et cetera, is the map. Yes. In terms of you have to compare in the 2012 election to the upcoming 2014 election. Anchorage is virtually unchanged in terms of the House seats. There are changes in the MATSU that are rather extensive, lines that have been redrawn here. There are lines that have been redrawn in Fairbanks. All of these are caused by a ripple effect. There was one district that stretched from the Bering Sea to Fairbanks that was basically created to meet the conditions of the Voting Rights Act in the last plan, the 2012 plan. That district no longer exists. It's no longer existing caused population to be pushed into Fairbanks, which then ripples down into the valley.
Right.
And what happened is right at basically the district that the valley shares with Chugiak, that district absorbed the remainders of the population after you go through this ripple effect, thereby leaving the rest of the map going south relatively unchanged in terms of House seats.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And, well, it makes sense in particular because we've had a lot of discussion. Many people have been talking here in the Valley about the changes that were thought might happen, and now that they have happened, what effect this does for the Valley delegation in terms of having people perhaps look at shifting from the House to the Senate or one thing or another. So for many people here, I suspect this election will require attention if you're a listener and you're a voter.
It will.
Say, what happened? I had this representative, but now I haven't moved, but they have.
They have. And again, it's part of the process. So you have a situation where you do have a couple of senators that are still going to be your senators. There are some changes. You have an open Senate seat here now.
Right.
And that open Senate seat is an actual manufacture of the House of MATSU gaining a House seat. As a consequence, you used to have Fred Dyson came popping up this way? No, he didn't. He went up to Chugiak and so represented the very lower part of that Chugiak Valley, you know, collaborative district. He is no longer anywhere in the valley. His district is strictly an Eagle River district now. Uh-huh. And he is pitted against another incumbent Republican and a fair cost. So those two Republicans will face each other, or one will step down, okay, you know, or choose not to run.
So just to remind listeners, we have presently two gentlemen who are in the Senate representing the Valley, Michael Dunleavy and Senator Huggins.
And you had a third because Fred Dyson represented that very small part
of
below the Parks and Glen Highway.
Right. But now we have, as you've nicely put, an open seat, and
no incumbent. That's correct.
And a no incumbent seat seems to attract people like something attracting lint. I mean, I don't know. Some, there are, I'm sure there are ways of describing this, but I already have heard a number of people who have gone beyond threatening to file, but have filed, and I'm going to guess that there are going to be a lot of people are going after that seat.
Well, like flies to processed food. Let's just say that that there should be a lot of people going for that seat. There's one. There's at least one incumbent House member that could potentially go for that seat, and that's Bill Stoltz from down in Chigiak, whose district now only represents a little bit of Palmer, Wausau area, but would be in that Senate district.
Right, and I think the discussion about Representative Stoltz has been that because he has, although he has represented a small portion of the valley, as you described, he's been prominent here.
His relatives are he has a number of relatives. The Milkey family live in the Palmer Wausau area as well.
So he's very familiar with it, and in some respects, I am guessing that people are waiting to see what he's going to do because he's been formidable in his House seat, and who knows?
Well, he's undisputedly the leader of the House Finance Committee. The House majority is not likely to change in the next election, though it probably will be reduced slightly. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a number of things that would go into a person making those kinds of decisions. I know, you know, I've known Bill for years, and in fact, I remember back when he used to be a Democrat, you know, working with –
We'll talk about those days.
The two of us worked together on the Charlie Parr for Lieutenant Governor campaign. But he has been consistent with his principles all the way through, and things have changed. And he has an interest in being, I think, Speaker of the House someday as well. So his interest has always been in the House. He worked for Senator Cotton when he was a senator briefly as staff. He also worked for a number of
– A president of the Senate one time.
Oh, yeah, he worked for Cotton when Cotton was in the Senate,
right?
As well as when Sam was in the House. He worked for Randy Phillips in the House and a number of other Ed Willis in the House, and so he's got a pretty storied connection to the House more than the Senate. So that's why I suspect he would stay. I don't think he was president of the Senate. He was Speaker of the House.
No, but there was a president of the Senate that Bill worked for.
I'm blanking on that.
And how? Okay. We'll come back to that. Obviously, these are so complicated.
He's the expert. He's the one who has this amazing
but he's been around.
Recollection of history there. But that said, you know, so that's part of the ripple that went through the map, created these opportunities in the valley.
Sure.
The Democrats filed suit. And again, I'm a partisan Democrat, and I freely confess that. But I went ahead and took worked for the board in the end to try to get this map finally approved because I thought it was a fair map. And fundamentally, what reapportionment hasn't been over the years has been fair. It's been a partisan process followed by a partisan process followed by a partisan process. And I think you ought to have a fair map. And that's what benefits Alaskan citizens. And when I say fair, what does that mean? It means some districts will be hard Republican, some will be hard Democrat because people choose to settle in areas around like-minded people. But you want to have the vast majority of those districts be what we call competitive. And that means where on a given day there is a shot somebody, you know, might win. Mm-hmm. And that's not always been the case. And I always use the example of Chris Tuck from Anchorage. You know, he ran in a seat that I helped draw back in 2001 that I told him would never be won by a Democrat, couldn't be won by a Democrat because there were so many Republicans concentrated in the district because that's where they chose to live. Mm-hmm. Fairly block-like district, but that's, you know, the nature of the district.
Sure.
He, of course, worked his heart out, and he worked very, very hard. And three elections later, he was a state House member, and in the last cycle, won by the largest margin he'd ever won by.
Whoa.
You know, he ended up winning every one of those precincts. So it can happen.
Sure.
That's competitive.
Well, you obviously are knowledgeable about Alaska, and what I am aware of is that around the country, there are districts that have been gerrymandered to purposely exclude certain portions of the population. Any sense of how we stack up against those places that have used that technique?
Well, you got to – first thing you do is you do the what we call the smell test. How many incumbents are pitted against each other? Mm-hmm. That's generally a sign of a very marked partisan reapportionment. And sometimes it's a mark of just accidents of the population growth. And
sure.
But in this particular instance, in this map, there are – four incumbents pitted against each other. two Republican senators, as I mentioned earlier, Fred Dyson, Anna Faircloth, and two Republican House members in Fairbanks. You know, mm-hmm. Tammy Wilson, and I'm blanking right now on the name of the other gentleman, the former mayor of North Pole, Doug. I'm just blanking on his last name, but the but they're up against each other in a primary. Mm-hmm. Now, in Fred's case, he'll probably step down, is what I understand. He has no interest in taking on Anna Faircloth in the Senate, so she'll likely be the uncontested in that Senate seat. But in the House up in Fairbanks, those are two North Pole residents that are going to go probably head to head. Well, so tell me, if you have a situation where the only incumbents paired are Republicans, is that really a gerrymandered plan? I think you'd have difficulty saying it is. Now, what did happen? It is true that the plaintiffs in the lawsuit wanted the West Fairbanks population, which is generally Democratic, to be placed back into Fairbanks. They got that. They wanted the Eielson population, which is the air base up there and generally votes Republican, mm-hmm. removed from an urban district and placed in a more rural district. They got that. But the fine lines that are drawn in between the districts, moving a precinct here, a precinct there, can on the surface appear to be gerrymandering. So the big complaint was about a thing they call the Anvil, which is a precinct of about 180 to 280 people, somewhere in that neighborhood. Well, that is not materially, with a 30% to 40% voter turnout, is not materially significant in determining whether a seat will or won't be Democrat or Republican. Okay. It is potentially looks weird, but that's probably the strangest one of the districts that we have here. There's been an argument that building an East Anchorage to Hillside Senate seat, which this map does, is, quote, gerrymandering. Within the city of Anchorage, you can draw those lines anywhere, and it's significantly less land area than that district used to have when it extended from Hillside to North Kenai down to Seward, which is what it used to do. When you compare that Senate seat to what it is now, it's significantly more compact. It's actually shares a demographic. Every one of these people vote for the same mayor, the same school board members, those kinds of things.
Okay.
So,
yeah, okay, that makes sense.
They abut the park.
All right. Right. So I'm aware also that we're about to go from 2013 to 2014. And as you yes. pointed out, they're just finishing up with a few of the details on this. And when did the process begin?
It begins with the census, actually. Right. So, you get the 2010 census. The numbers come out in 2011. In 2011, the board began to the board was constituted prior to that. And then the board began to meet and held public hearings around the state. I actually went to a couple of them, and I testified a few times. My clients at the time were former senator now, the late Al Adams, and Sea Alaska Corporation, and then later Chilista Corporation, both Native corporations. I worked for them and basically was pushing Alaska Native interests so that we would not see a diminution of Alaska Native voting power, which mm-hmm. was something we feared mm-hmm. with a fairly urban-oriented and conservative board.
Mm-hmm. So would you say at this time that that did not happen?
No, it definitely didn't happen. And not only was the board, though not initially, they came around to the idea that we were trying to help. And we very much took a position separate from a number of the other groups. We were trying not to be antagonistic. Whenever the board faced an obstacle, we offered up solutions. Which is something that hasn't been done readily in the process before. Okay. It's always been to wait for the other side to fail and then, pound on them. And what we tried to do with all of my clients is to continually offer solutions so that in the end, they invited myself and Randy Rudrick to sit down because mm-hmm. they recognized that we didn't see eye to eye at a partisan level, mm-hmm. but they were willing to listen to our discussion of how, districts ought to be formed. And frankly, Randy and I agreed on about 30 House districts. We felt that those 30 were relatively fine. Mm-hmm. I got to recognize that the board is fundamentally a partisan body,
right.
And to get a fair map out of that body, is different than a fair map might look out of four Democrats drawing the lines. But they're both relative degrees of fairness. Do you see what I'm
sure.
saying?
Yeah, I understand that. So you've had experience in the past. You've had experience with this most recent redistricting effort. Where do you see all of this going? Because that's only another 6 years.
Well, but see, there was a case, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court took up a Texas case. And what that case did, they eventually found in favor of they found in favor of certain elements of an argument and against others. But what that basically did was it threw the process of redistricting open. We've always traditionally done it every decade. The Supreme Court has said, nah, if you need to do it because of major changes somewhere mid-decade, they've opened the door to that. So we could have a disaster on our hands if that actually happened, a permanently seated, you know, board that would never go away because the way that our Constitution reads is the board sits until the map is done. So I'm relatively happy now that we have a map that everyone has said is done because that does terminate this board. But
okay. But
we could have carried lawsuits on all through the decade, you know, and that's what the national or the federal Supreme Court has opened up in all these cases. So what do we face? Here's what I say to people. If you really care about this process and you're a partisan Republican or a partisan Democrat, then you need to be sure that your party controls at least the governorship or one or more of the two bodies of our representative government, Senate or the House. And if you're doing a coalition, you should negotiate for that seat, you know, so regardless of which party you are.
Okay. Well, that seems not a bad suggestion to provide as long as people are willing to negotiate and talk to one another, to have differences, the different bodies and the governor. Yeah, that makes sense to me, or seems to make sense.
It makes sense. Here's what we know. I was part of the 91 redistricting retained by the Department of Law for what was then the Alaska Independence Party administration, the Hickel administration. I was retained by the Knowles Department of Law for the Knowles redistricting, and then by the law firm representing the reapportionment board in this redistricting process.
Okay.
And in each case, the boards all mitigated to the middle in the end, and the plans were governed essentially by court decisions. We have a working process, and even though we changed the process of how the board was appointed after the Hickel reapportionment, which was back in 90, our courts at both the district level as well as the Supreme Court level have been very meticulous in ensuring that we have as fair a process as possible. And they have called the parties on it, both the state side and from the those who have challenged. And in this case, you know, they ruled in favor of the state, finally, summary judgment at the district court level on all counts. That's pretty significant. None of us expected that. I'm certain they didn't. On that side, and certainly we didn't on our side. But my point being that we're very lucky to have the court system we have because it really does allow us to have a reasonably fair system. And the one or two times that system's gone awry, our courts have been able to slingshot it back into shape. So, mm-hmm. And we have a good system, and it's working here. So I'm not afraid of 6 years from now. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thank you. I've been talking here with Tom Begich, who has, as you've just heard, an extensive history with redistricting, reapportionment, and all the rest, the fallout that comes from that. Tom, any last comments?
I guess I do have one last comment, which is to really make this work, you have to have competitive races in every race. That means Democrats running in every race and Republicans running in every race. That way you can know the real picture of what Alaska represents and give everyone an opportunity to vote. At the very least, there should be challenges in every race and no one should go unopposed. So I'm hoping to see that whether it's the Valley or the Bush, everyone has an opponent so that we can hold ourselves accountable because that's the true measure of representative government.
All right. Thank you, Tom.